Welcome to the Volterra podcast number 17. Is that it? 17?
It's the one I put on the audio file, so I think it is for that, yeah.
For better or for worse, it's number 17. I'm Rowan Kane. I'm here with Louis Rive. I just found out it's Louis Rive. I'm pronouncing your name wrong for all of 16 episodes. It's Louis Rive, really?
It is, yeah, but like, it's okay. Everybody does it. Very, very rarely people get it right. So, hi, but I'm doing good, yeah.
You could have told me at least.
I never tell anyone. Otherwise, it's just I'd have to speak like double the amount than I usually do. So
I think Reeve gives you like a French twist that I think you like. But anyway, Louis here today as well as Ben Schreckinger. How are we doing, Ben?
Ron, it's actually pronounced Schrecklinger.
Okay, so I've been pronouncing it wrong for what?
17 years
now. 15 years, yeah. Okay.
Something like that.
All right. Good. How are we doing today, guys?
Fine and dandy.
Yeah.
I second that motion.
What's that?
I second that motion. Fine and dandy. We're good. Yeah.
It is currently 9:30 in on the Eastern Seaboard. It is 2:30 in the United Kingdom and 3:30 here in France.
You're in France? Wow.
Cool. I'm in France. I'm currently in France, yeah. Yeah. For 5 days or so.
Nice.
Little jaunt. Little weekend affair. Even though, or week affair. Anyway, let's get to our topics for today. First, we had a email from one of our few listeners. About a news item from the UK that I'm not sure if this has been in the news at all, though, but British pubs are generally owned by or have contracts with one brewery. And that means they get all their beer, all their alcohol from this one brewery, one distributor. And apparently, according to this article, a law just passed that opened up the purchasing of alcohol to any from any distributor, from any brewery. So pubs are no longer beholden to one brewery versus the market. It basically opens up the market. Lou, has this been in the media all over there, in the news?
No, unsurprisingly, over here in Britain, they've managed to keep that one pretty quiet. That potentially the price of beer would come down. I think there'd be anarchy on the streets, so to speak, if people were aware of this this issue. As a man that does quite a lot of drinking myself, I haven't yet noticed any like sort of sizable change to the pittance that I get on a round from a £20 note. So clearly, it's not been fully implemented just as of yet.
Yeah, I think it's a couple months or a couple, maybe a year or so off. But I mean, this would kind of the dropping in price would go against everything that the UK has been trying to do for the past at least since I've been there, or I was there. They're about trying to raise the price so that there's no anti-social behavior, as they call it.
Well, I mean, I wish them the best of luck. I really can't see how on earth that one will go through, but I'm all for it. Anything to kind of shave anything off the price of a pint of beer, which I suppose beer itself is one of the most overpriced things in the entire world. There's quite a big culture for it here, especially in London, because of this kind of craft brewery scene that's plagued the pubs around here. Meaning that we like import beer from New Zealand and stuff and charge £6.50 for a bottle of it, which is a sad affair. I think it would be good to actually kind of get back to the sort of the roots of it and getting beer from places that it's made, i.e. England and you know, I know you guys make it as well, but we do have quite a lot of it on our back door here, so it would it would be a sensible thing to do.
Yeah.
Are we sure this is actually happening? I was just Googling around. I couldn't find a news story about this.
Yeah. This was a lead from one of our listeners. I don't know. whether it actually is a news item or not is one thing, but the actual idea that pubs have to buy their alcohol from one distributor or one brewery, I know, is a law. So whether the law is being revoked or what, the actual issue that is at hand that is that pubs are there's no open market for beer.
How would I Google that law? What's the name of that law? You know,
Ben, Louis, do you have any idea?
Ooh, I have absolutely none.
Look up brewery pub relationship.
Brewery in like UK brewery pub. Okay.
Yeah.
Brewery pub relationship.
I mean, the main issue is breweries own the pubs. That's why they have like an exclusive access to it.
Right.
They own the actual sort of building, or they pay the rent on it anyway.
Brewery pub ownership.
Okay, yeah, there is something in the Telegraph. I just wasn't Googling well enough.
Hmm.
And what's
Okay, this is all happening. Sorry.
Okay, all right.
Momentarily.
No, good. It's a good to have a little bit of skepticism to any topics that I bring to the pod.
So, Ron, is that wine? Is that grape juice? Is that coffee?
That's wine. It's wine.
Hey.
It's wine. Hey. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it is Tuesday afternoon, so.
Exactly. It's 3:30. 3:30. I'm going to show you guys the bottle here. Very, it's like locally sourced, that kind of bullshit.
Wonderful. Yeah. Are there hills where you are? Like, is this legitimate wine?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm in Nîmes at the moment. So, so down the south. There's this wonderful thing. It's called We Go, like the French word we and then go. And it's like 10 euros from Paris to the south. So, Lou, if you're looking for a little break of some sort with the lady, I would recommend it.
What about that? Fair enough. I'll keep that one in mind.
10 euros, 10 to 15 euros from Paris to Aix or Montpellier or Nîmes or Lyon or...
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you're on the odyssey of a lifetime, Rowan, and you still took time out to chat with us.
Yeah.
Wow.
I wouldn't call it odyssey of a lifetime, but it's a fun little excursion.
Is that a failed jab at Nadia, Rowan?
What's that?
Let's work this out. We have a platform. We have the time. We have your buddies. What's wrong, Rowan?
Nothing's wrong.
Beer in Nîmes,
what's that?
You drink this local wine. I said if you could get cheaper beer in Nîmes, would these problems all go away?
No. There are no problems, so.
Oh, now I've caught you in a contradiction.
That the problems would go away, and that, yeah. You're just too logically advanced for me, Benjamin.
I know, it's tough, it's tough.
Yeah. But no, this has actually been, Nîmes is a wonderful city. I would recommend it to anybody. The most... intact Roman arena,
correct,
yeah,
hold on,
and one of the most intact Roman temples are both in Nîmes. It is in fact called the Rome of France.
Easy. It's a very good place. I've been myself. I enjoyed it. It was very nice.
Were you here in the winter or in the summer?
I was there last spring, actually.
Oh, I feel like spring would be a lovely time.
It was very pleasant. They have a lot of places to sit in stereotypical kind of pavements, sidewalks, and hang about sort of drinking all day, which is a great thing, I think, for me personally anyway. So.
Yeah. Let's get back to talking about other ways of drinking. So, Ben, what does that article say? Did you get any... Any traction on the search?
Pub landlords have won historic victory over changes to their relationship with big breweries, which could set them free from the controversial beer tie system with its restrictions on the purchase of drinks from competitors and limits on freedom of rent agreements has been blamed for the increase in pub closures, uncompetitive prices, and the failure to attract more tenants. So I still don't understand the exact mechanics of this law, but yeah, it seems to be that pubs can force that breweries can force pubs or landlords of pubs to only buy their product, which is not good for a marketplace.
No.
It's a good thing that they've got going. I've got to be honest. They like the pub system in Britain is quite unique. You guys don't really have it in America or in France for that matter, or anywhere actually. Like, it really is the only place that has the concept of a pub is the UK. And I suppose kind of Ireland as well. But they, they've been shutting down at like an alarming rate. I think it's like three a day on average pubs close in Britain as a result of being, no doubt. Yeah. But it's just people getting priced out of being able to drink, which used to be the only sort of solace of the kind of the damned, but has now, become like quite an exclusive thing.
In Ireland, it's partially that younger people are drinking cheaper liquor from liquor stores, but also that there are new like drunk drive laws out in the country, and so many people have left the country, so many young people have left the country, that it's like country pubs especially. Is that going on in the UK, or is it literally just prices?
No. We have exactly the same as... Bit, like Ireland is very similar to what goes on here. They just use different money. But in terms of kind of the social side of everything, it's absolutely the same thing. We just had like new drink drive laws, which are a bit confusing because they change depending on what country you're in the UK. You can drink more in England, but if you're going to drive into Scotland, then like you may be over the limit without knowing it.
That's because Scotland famously can't hold their liquor, correct?
I think it's Scotland holds too much liquor on too many occasions is probably the main issue behind that. There's just a big drive to kind of get people to, well, a big drive to get people to not drink anything while driving. I know it's different in America where you guys, like some people actually take the car to the bar in order to drive back.
That's what I was going to say, is that in the U.S., you have to drive to the bar.
Yeah.
Like, there's no – unless you live in a city like where Ben lives or like D.C. or New York or – but even out west in cities, you need to bring – you need to have a designated driver. And I think the designated driver that it exists in American culture a lot more than it exists in – British culture. Would you say that, Ben?
I don't know how much the designated drivers is a big thing in American culture. I don't know if it exists.
But that's it does. I don't think it exists in the UK.
There's like sometimes the kind of like
in the 90s by beer companies or something is why it's like a huge thing in the US. I think that is the case.
Right. What were you gonna say, Luke?
I mean, there's I've worked in places where people have like ordered a driving beer, for example, which is like usually a slightly lower alcohol beer than everyone else. I mean, it's irrelevant when they drink like 8 pints of it. It sort of loses its potency as the driving beer. But it's usually just the guy that's the least fucked, I suppose, would be selected as the guy that would potentially drive.
Right. But that in the U.S. you have a designated driver that comes with you and he just doesn't drink for the entire night, and that starts in like high school.
We did that in high school, but then in college no one was driving. Since college, no one's really been driving. I guess more like urbanized. If you live a very urban lifestyle, that sort of goes away because you're using a combination of public transit and taxis and Uber. So I guess that system probably does still exist in places where people are like driving together to bars. I guess I just haven't experienced that recently.
Yeah, no, but that's the thing. I have in Connecticut, especially. Like, unless you're in New Haven or a couple other places, in Connecticut, you're always driving to a bar, always. So you're either counting, okay, I can only have like 3 beers, and then after that, it's getting a little sketchy about whether I drive home. Or you get someone to come pick you up, or you have someone with you who isn't drinking. I mean, I never saw, I never had to, because in UK you could always take a taxi home. That's the thing. The town sizes, the geographic sizes are a lot smaller in the UK. So everyone's like lives around in a village or in a everyone who lives in the countryside lives in a village. So it's a lot easier to get from their pub to their house by a taxi or walking or whatever. Whereas in the US there's suburbs and you have to drive down Stepford Wife Lane to get home.
Mm.
Yeah. So okay, I think that's enough chat about the new pub law. Do you guys have anything else to add to it?
No, just if they make cheaper beer, I would be marginally happier here. That would be about it, really.
Actually, Ben, have you gotten into like the craft beer culture at all in the U.S.?
Not really. I mean, I've like gone with my brother and sister to like a little craft brewery, like home batch place, and made beer. But like, I go into a liquor store, I buy a beer based on like the label. If I'm looking at a beer list at a restaurant or a bar, I'll base it on the name. I can't really tell from beer so much. So no.
Okay. And
what about you?
I do. I've dove deep into the craft beer. There was a couple of people on the campaign that I was working with that were really into craft beer, and like I didn't pick up on it because I already like drinking nice beer from the Netherlands. But I don't know. I like the whole finding out what kind of beer you like and then trying different types of that beer and trying to not pay too much for it, but that's always
ultimately failing. Yeah, no.
Ultimately failing, yeah. But I mean, in the U.S., it's you're gonna get a six pack for like $10. Anything over $10 for a six pack is too much.
Hmm.
Maybe twelve. But then that's $2 a beer. So it's not like in the UK where you're paying £2 of beer and it's...
Oh, £2 is dear. Where are you buying beer from? Like, the £1 like, can is the building right, block of life
store.
Here.
Is it more, if you buy a six pack at a liquor store for like nice beer, is it more than 12 quid?
If you bought six beers for 12 quid, I would expect to be drinking like one of the finest beers that God had to offer.
Say that again?
I would be expecting like, a heavenly beer if it was 12 quid for six.
Really? From a liquor store?
Yeah.
I guess.
I mean, we don't really have them, but from like the supermarket or the offie, yeah.
Yeah.
Unless you are like into some like crazy ales and stuff like that.
Right, but isn't how much is like a tenant's in from the liquor store? Like,
if you buy in bulk, under a quid a can.
Yeah.
Maybe 80 pence a can.
There you go.
It's rock and roll, yeah.
It's rock and roll. And tenant special is what?
A quid, pretty much, quid. Most of the time.
Yeah.
And it gets you going, so there, yeah.
Two of those and you're well in.
Yeah, fine.
All right, so let's change speeds real quick. And actually, not changing speeds. Here's a segue. Do you guys drink when you write?
I'll let you feel that one first, Ben. I feel there's a can of worms coming here. So yeah, kind of.
I don't. Maybe I have once or twice, but not really. No.
So we're gonna talk process now about how we write, and this is a little maybe a little esoteric, more kind of vague in topic. We mainly talked about new subjects, but this is more I don't know. It's just a subject. So trying something new. How do you guys? So you don't drink when you write. How do you guys find topics? Louis, why don't you go first?
I find a lot of the time the writing seems to come when I'm at like quite low ebbs in my existence, which happens quite frequently with the sort of work I do. It's a bit of a, what do you call it? a catch-22 situation in that a lot of my best work that has been published and has earned me money is written as a direct result of working a terrible job or being in some awful situation. So that if I ever do really kind of, if I ever made writing a complete career, I may run out of material unless I continue to live this pitiful existence that I find myself in on several occasions. But usually the kind of most acerbic, and obviously you've read a lot of my stuff, the most sort of acerbic and maybe prophetic work comes from the lower ebbs of my existence anyway.
Yeah, and so you do drink when you write, right, or you don't?
Oh, sometimes I'm absolutely blazed when I do it, yeah. So, usually...
Write drunk, edit sober?
Vaguely, yeah. I mean, a lot of the time I'm writing, like, after I'm at a shift or something, and I quite often drink at work, like, quite heavily in order to make the time go by a little bit quicker.
Where are you working right now?
I work anywhere, really, that pays, but usually, like, sort of... anonymous bar shifts or that sort of thing, which is pretty good, actually. Well, it's not, it's awful, but it's, you know, I can get fired into, like, the free beer and kind of leave whenever I want, because I don't care about being fired at all. It's not a great way, but it occasionally pays me, and that's fine.
What kind of shifts are these, you said, at bars?
Yeah, anonymous bar shifts, whatever, yeah, I'll do anything.
There's a market for that?
Yeah, you just sign up. They always need barmen.
I guess that's true. So we're talking about very different types of writing between the three of us.
Yeah, what about yourself, Rowan? Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Well, I do drink when I write sometimes. It kind of depends on how I feel or what I'm writing about. So just stylistically, Ben, you're much more... you're a journalist, for all intents and purposes, right?
Uh-huh.
Is how you label your writing?
Yeah, I'd say I'm a journalist.
Yeah. And Louis, how would you label your writing? Would you say experiential? Is that a word?
If it's not a word, it's a good word. But either way, it's I think, like, first person narrative writer rather than a journalist, really.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, and I would. I mean, you guys have only read, like, some of my. Well, if you have read any of my writing, it's much more. How would you label it?
Kind of current affairs, but not always, because I read your one about the sports that you put up about the history of sports, which is a very good article.
Thank you.
I guess you'd call it.
What's that?
One of it, I would say, is, like, cultural essays.
Yeah, like, opinion kind of pieces on culture.
So we do kind of run the spectrum of writing, I guess you could say, of at least nonfiction writing. And Ben, how do you find your subjects?
A lot of it recently, especially, has been assignments. Some of the more interesting things I've done that I think are some of the more interesting things. Like, I wrote a story about how I thought bars were too loud and cafes were too quiet, and it was, like, ruining civic discourse in America.
I remember that one.
And that was, like, I'd always been complaining about bars being too loud. Because it just, like, sucks to go to the bars these days. You, like, can't really talk to people. You know, you can't hit on girls. You can't have conversations with people. So that's, like, long been a complaint of mine. Then I was, like, sort of hungover on a Chinatown bus from Boston to New York one day, like, staring out a window and thinking about, I think, the fact that when I go to New York and I stay at my friend Sam's place, I spend a lot of time in cafes on the Lower East Side. And I was thinking about, like, that and the fact that, you know, this was Lower Manhattan, but that, and you'd expect these cafes to be, like, lively or something, but they're super quiet because people are, like, there on their laptops. And I think that idea just sort of came, those two things sort of snapped together for me, and I knew pretty quickly I had a good idea. I did something about, like, about how, like, the week just sort of had this like little epiphany that the week is like a totally arbitrary unit of time. That came from a book by Jared Diamond about comparing modern lifestyles to the lifestyles of indigenous people. And it was just sort of in contemplating the lifestyle of an indigenous person that it was like, oh yeah, these people, like, it's logical that they would mark time in days and years and even months to a certain extent because of the moon. The lunar cycle is a month approximately, and our month is based on the lunar cycle. There's no fucking way they'd have a week, a 7-day week. You know, that's just utter chance. Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know. Just, like, take long walks, take showers, that sort of stuff.
Showers, for real. For real. Showers are where I do my best thinking. Like, Nadi, my girlfriend makes fun of me for how long I take my showers. But because – it's literally because I am on it, like, thinking the entire time. I'm more clear-headed and the synapses are firing quicker in the shower than at any other point during my day.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is.
There is science.
I think there is, yeah. There's definitely some science. But Ben, one more thing. Where did you come up with that unovation? I think we talked about it when we talked about it on the pod. But where did you come up with that? Louis, did you read about that, the unovation?
I did not know. I remember discussing it on the pod though, yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead, Ben.
So that was, I had sort of long just been thinking about the fact that as an input of when the most expensive input is labor, that like factory style farming is efficient, but in terms of like all other inputs, you know, like land and resources, it's inefficient, and there are a lot of other drawbacks to it. And so I sort of have been kicking around in the back of my head sort of the advantages of smaller scale agriculture for a while. And also just like the future of like the economy in a place like New England. And I was approached by an editor at the Globe's editorial page section, about like writing some op-eds, and I threw out some ideas, and he was like, yeah, like what about doing something about like the divergent fates of Boston and the rest of the region? Because the city of Boston and the area around Boston inside of Route 128 is usually how that geographic unit is constrained, is doing incredibly well, better than ever before. Life sciences, robotics, you know, thriving universities. And then there are other parts of the state that, you know, they're doing better than Appalachia, that's for sure. But compared to Boston, they're struggling. We have these gateway cities, which are these old industrial cities. It was sort of born out of going back and forth with this editor on like, well, like, what can we write about this issue? And, this was the first thing that jumped in my mind, and I had to make a case for it, over a succession of emails and calls with the editor. But eventually, you know, I got enough. We tweaked the exact point enough, and I got enough supporting evidence that it turned into this op-ed.
Yeah,
that was well received.
And when you're actually writing, when you're in the process of writing, is it one kind of like stream, and you do like one of those probably, I don't know, 2,000 word kind of like spurts at once, or is it kind of is it slower? I assume it's probably pretty quick and you get it all out of the page, right?
It depends on what it is. I mean, yeah, sometimes they're quite short little pieces, which are just little vignettes of something grim that I've seen or what I've done that was bad in the week, that sort of thing. Otherwise, I do kind of go on sort of rambling narratives, which is actually how I got any writing picked up in the first place, where I sort of wrote one long narrative about working as a bookmaker in London, and I sent it to some people, and it was Vice that picked it up first and said, this is the kind of thing. But then obviously that it was like a block of text rather than any kind of succinct article, and it was kind of edited down. So a few of them are kind of longer pieces that are then, I guess, poached for the for sort of more relevant bits and then sent out.
Yeah. And you're also working on a much longer kind of piece, right? Aren't you working, I don't want to give anything away, but aren't you working on a book length kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of add to this running monologue of my life on kind of minimum wage jobs and sort of borderline drinking problem, which is cool. And trying to make it, yeah, just like a kind of semi-autobiographical account of just living a pretty non-entity of an existence in London.
Yeah.
Inspired quite heavily by writers like Charles Bukowski and that sort of thing. Anyway.
Yeah. Ben, have you thought about writing anything longer? I mean, I know you're going into kind of in-depth into Politico now, but are you thinking of putting together anything book length, or I know you've done features, so.
I would like to. I think it's just, you know, as a matter of, you know, finding the right project. You know, I think it's more important to have something you really want to do that happens to be book length than to want to do something book length for the sake of it without being compelled, especially by any idea. Right. But yeah, I like the idea of doing it.
Yeah. And what about, so Ben, it seems like you have a lot of kind of contact with editors, a lot of give and take with them about what you're going to be writing about, length, content, etc. What is that? Do you enjoy that? Because that's a stupid question. But is that something that you? Why don't you just go into that and talk about your kind of what your relationship with editors is like?
Sure. I mean, it's definitely I went freelance. After I think like 9 months or so of what was to have been a year long fellowship. That was my first gig out of college, which just meant that I went freelance without a lot of relationships with editors and without a lot of experience in any form dealing with new editors or anything like that. And my, you know, the main thing I had done was been on a college newspaper, which is a very different dynamic. Every story you sit with your editor and read through it with them because they're keeping you. So the experience of just like reaching out to sort of semi-random people, maybe I'd been introduced by someone, maybe I'd met them in passing or something, is definitely stressful and trying. And, you know, if you're like super unsure of whether you're going to make any money or be able to support yourself doing this thing, it can be very stressful to just be like hanging on a thread waiting for an email from an editor.
Right.
So that part like sucks. Eventually, you know, you start working regularly with people and you get to know them. And you also get to know the patterns of editors. So if there's an editor who is just like going to not see or like, respond to your email for a long time, it becomes less stressful because you just expect that. So the whole conducting a relationship with an editor via email is just sort of a weird thing. I'm definitely looking forward to being back in a newsroom in January and just like having a more, like more normal relationships with editors that involve like in person and the ability to, and like maybe it's partially my fault because I think a lot of editors are like, hey, if you want to talk about this story, like here's my number, you know, call me. And I'm not usually one to pick up the phone and be like, hey, let's like chat this out. I think that if I were in a newsroom and I just had like more of a rapport with different editors that will change and that will be really good. You know, I think that's how really great stories arise is often from just like having like long ongoing discussions with editors and stuff.
With people in general, with other people in general, I think not just editors, but hashing it out. And Lou, what is your relationship? I mean, you've done a lot of stuff with Vice. Do you have any relationships with any editors there? What's the kind of process that you go through with them?
Yeah, I do. In the beginning, again, like following on from Ben's point, it's one of these editors you email and it takes the time it takes to get anything back is indefinite, and occasionally stuff will go up without you even noticing or being told, which is a bit of a pain in the ass. It would be a lot easier if you could just meet someone, ask what they want, and then kind of work it out there and then. But I guess it's just the nature of the business with the amount of stuff they're getting in. But now that I've had quite a few articles published for them, I can do a quick plug. There was one came out a couple of days ago. There you go. Then it's a lot easier because they sort of know the style. They know what they know you have what they want, and it's just a lot easier to get in contact with them. Basically, they come back a lot quicker, and the process is a lot smoother than it is when you're first kind of on the scene of it.
Yeah.
Right. And are you guys protective at all of what you write? Are you kind of do you want to keep it as true to the original topic of or original kind of content as possible, or are you more flexible in terms of putting changing tone, changing content as to what the editor wants?
I think it depends for me a lot from piece to piece. If it's like, you know, that essay I'm writing on bars and cafes or abolishing the week, that's sort of like my idea that I came up with and wrote this essay and submitted it. You know, I'm not going to want it to get screwed around with too much. And, right. You know, in the case of this essay, they were, you know, the final product was pretty true to the original submission. With tweaks that, you know, probably made it better. If it's a different kind of assignment, if it's something that's assigned to me and I'm sort of uncertain about what the story is really supposed to look like and I just don't have a strong vision for it anyways, or just don't feel as much ownership of the piece, then I care much less if it gets, you know, seriously tinkered with.
Yeah. So going back to actually the actual writing itself, when do you guys, are you guys just like sit down 9 to 5 and try and write? I know that's probably more Ben than Louis, but when do you write is basically, Louis, you said you write after shifts, kind of when you're at a low point and you want to just get it on paper?
Yeah, a lot of the time. Spur of the moment. Sometimes it comes, sometimes it doesn't. I very rarely sit down specifically to write, if that's the kind of thing you're getting at. I don't think I ever do.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was asking.
Yeah, I very rarely sort of set aside a day, because then I won't do shit at all. I'll just sit and watch South Park and drink beer. So it's, you know, it's impossible. But yeah, no, it's more, yeah, sometimes it happens and you can get a lot of words out, and then sometimes nothing. But hey, it's a creative process, isn't it?
I definitely try to keep it to, you know, weekday business hours. That definitely does not always happen. Like probably most writers, I tend to push up against deadlines. Procrastinate. I think that's pretty common. And I'll have a pretty good sense often of how I want to start the piece. Yeah. And like, get started with a head of steam and like lay out, you know, my vision for like how the thing starts and start going from there. And then sort of after that, you can sort of lose momentum, or I tend to sort of lose momentum, and it can turn into something of a slog.
No, I'm definitely the same as that. Like I'm kind of in between you two guys. I will come up with a topic, and I'll often come up with the first kind of like paragraph of what I want to say in the paragraph, and the structure of whatever argument I'm trying to make. But then I'll start writing, and I'll kind of pick up. I'll have ideas about what like comments I want to make, and I'll like research to those comments, if you know what I mean. Like I'll look up things as I go that I think are right. And if they're right, I'll continue that train of thought. And if they're wrong, I'll have to reverse and kind of come at it from a different direction. Because I do want as much of my writing as possible to be, to have a good kind of factual basis. I don't like pull facts out of midair and try and like, that's, you have to do that a lot in academia, which is where like how my writing style developed.
Do what?
Like, if you want to make a topic, you can pull quotes from certain sections that aren't, like, kind of pull quotes out of context every once in a while. And, yeah, the larger part...
You shouldn't do that in any kind of writing.
No, it's not... I'm not saying, like, pull quotes out of context and say, like, if the article is saying A and you pull a quote out saying B, saying, like, that... I'm talking around myself here. If the article is arguing for something, and in the article, in the argument, they say the opposite of that, I'm not going to pull out that argument and put it in and say this person did this. But there is a certain amount of artful insertion of quotes into academic writing. I would say that about how you are making your point. You don't want to put the wrong quote in the wrong context, is what I'm saying. Does that make sense?
Isn't that true of any kind of writing? I guess I'm just sort of confused because at first it sounded like you were like people in academic writing are like bullshitting.
No, I'm not sure that's that far off the mark, to be honest.
Yeah, no, they don't bullshit, but they definitely use quotes when... They're definitely more artful at using quotes from other because when you're writing in academia, it's literally quote after quote after quote after quote, or paraphrasing after paraphrasing after paraphrasing after paraphrasing to make a point. And yeah, I guess that's kind of like journalism, but in journalism, you also take quotes from interview and from other sorts of research. Or your own research, and I guess I'm saying it's basically journalism is basically like academia but with a different style. I don't know. I kind of talked myself in a circle there.
That's all right. Don't worry about it. It's the nature of the business.
It is the nature of the business. What do you say, Ben?
Oh, nothing.
Okay. Where was I before that? Yeah. So when you finished, how do you guys edit? Do you just kind of go read through the whole thing? Do you edit as you go? Louis, what's your editing process?
Well, I can barely, like, my English is terrible. So I usually, like, as you have edited some of my work, you will know that, yeah, I usually leave it to sort of higher bodies to do the, because it's not that I'm lazy. I am lazy. That's a different aside. But my English just isn't up to scratch, I don't think, in order to do it myself.
Yeah, Ben.
I'll edit as I go, pretty continuously, and then I like to like finish up a draft, give it some space, and come back to it and try to edit it.
Yeah.
But deadlines don't always allow for that.
Yeah, that's kind of the more textbook way. Yeah, I don't edit at the end. Because I trust my editing process through it, so I'll read it as I go, and like I'll read and then start writing. If I leave something, because I never finish something in one setting. I'll read through it and then pick up kind of where I left off after reading through it, and I'll edit as I go. So that stops me from writing a lot, is that I'll go through editing and I'll be like, well, fuck, I've just edited 400 words. I'm not going to want to write anymore. And then I'll leave and then I'll come back and I'll read the last 200 or something and then start writing. So that's a favorite procrastination method of mine. All right. Yeah. Do you guys have anything else you want to add about your specific process, which is a terrible word, but.
Nah, not really. I mean, yeah, it's just, get it done. If any aspiring writers are listening to this, just do it and see what happens. You never know.
Ben, what was that face for before?
That was a shrug, but I would second what Louis says. Yeah, get it done. That's the big thing. Like, no matter how you go about doing it, just get it done.
If I can get paid for writing, anyone can. So, like, go for it.
I don't know, Lou. I think you're selling yourself short a little bit.
Oh, well.
All right. Well, that is Volterra Podcast number 17. Follow me on Twitter at RLM Kane. Follow Ben at Shrek Reports, S-C-H-R-E-C-K. I get that wrong every single time. And follow Louis at Deep Fried Fiddle. Follow Volterra at The Volterra. I think that's it. Have a good weekend, boys. Or week. It's Tuesday. Have a good week.
Will do.
All right.
Gentlemen, see you next time.
Bye now.